This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Central Time, the Affordable Care Act just celebrated its fifth anniversary. We'll talk to a Wisconsin and national expert about how this law is changing the way rural hospitals operate and about the state of rural hospitals in general. First, the Wisconsin Badgers are headed to the NCAA championship in Indianapolis tonight for the first time in 74 years. Their only other appearance in the championship, which they won, was in 1941, only 2 years after the tournament began. On Saturday, the Badgers beat undefeated Kentucky, a particularly gratifying win for the team since they lost to Kentucky in the Final Four last year. Tonight, they'll face Duke University, a team they lost earlier in the season. The game begins tonight at 8:18 p.m. Joining us from Indianapolis is WPR's reporter Chuck Quirnbach. Chuck, good to have you here.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, first off, you have just arrived in Indianapolis. What's the scene like from a fan perspective?
Well, they're closer to the stadium. There are groups of people, some wearing red, I guess, who are cheering for, and some wearing blue, the Blue Devils of Duke. Fans milling about. I'm about a half mile away. A very large parking lot. There's much cheaper parking prices than last year in Arlington. So the big RVs have pulled up, some buses, and then a number of cars. This is where the Indianapolis Colts of pro football team plays, Lucas Oil Stadium. So there are various fields and lots close to the stadium that accommodate those folks, and we found one of those out there, but not too far out there, not too pricey lots a little while ago.
Yeah, and I saw some tweets from the UW-Madison advising students to check with their professors as to whether classes will be held, so I'm wondering how many people have skipped their first day back from spring break just to be there. It'll be interesting to see how the crowd evens out in terms of the red versus the blue.
I spoke with some of the fans in this lot, and one of them was indeed a first-year student at Madison who couldn't resist the attraction, he said, of his girlfriend being here, but of course he is enjoying it as well, and I forgot to remind him that it's a day of class, supposedly, but, there's some folks that will be here that maybe are not going to be in class, and we'll see if they show up for class tomorrow morning. That's the
That's right. Well, there will be classes throughout the semester, but maybe only one championship game for a while. Give us some context, though, in terms of the importance of this game, not just the fact that this is the first championship in 74 years that they're headed into, but how has the season shaped up to bring the Badgers to this point?
Well, first thing we should say in a news program that it is only basketball, okay? Mm-hmm. But given that, it is important in several factors, as you talked about, going in, is that the first final two, really, appearance of the Badgers in 74 years. This is a team that's been high-ranked all year, had a couple of stumbles along the way, had a major injury to one of its guards, Trayvon Jackson, but has done well pretty consistently all year and has gotten very good during the tournament, the NCAA tournament, won five games in the tournament, won a few games in the Big Ten tournament after winning the official season Big Ten championship anyway. So they've been very hot the last few weeks and playing strong ball throughout. Up against Duke, one of the royalties of college basketball, so to speak, but the Badgers beat another monarch, if you will, Kentucky, 2 days ago. So it can be done. Duke, my coach Mike Krzyzewski, a four-time NCAA champion coach. He's got a good team again, and 34-4, they are coming in. They've done well. They beat Wisconsin back in early December, and now some of the newspaper reporters are reminding us that Sam Decker, a key Wisconsin player, was hurt going into that game, was limited in his mobility. He didn't play as well. They are hoping Decker, who is one of the stars for Wisconsin, will play well and make it a very close game tonight.
So statistically, it might sound like Duke is the favorite to take the championship, but are you hearing otherwise, or do you have a sense that the Badgers will put up a good fight?
Well, Duke has the experience in matters such as these Final Fours more than Wisconsin has. Wisconsin last year and then about 15 years ago or 14 years ago was in the Final Four, but has not had a lot of time at playing in April, so to speak. But Wisconsin has been very dedicated. They played well, very fundamentally good basketball throughout. And they have seemed to play well in the last few minutes of the game, especially. They've been down sometimes in the second half. But in the last few minutes, all of a sudden, they're ahead by a few. And then at the end, they're ahead by six or seven. And they've done it by free throws. They've done it by not making mistakes at the end. But again, all that will be tested against Duke, which ran over basically Michigan State in their semifinal 2 days ago by about 20 points. It's a very tough matchup for Wisconsin.
And do you think that Bo Ryan's strategy is changing at all for this game, or do you think they will stick with the tried and true game strategies they've brought forward so far?
Well, the Badgers do have to adjust to some of the Duke key players. There's a center, Jahlil Okafor, who is Duke's top scorer. There's some other very good players, Tyus Jones, Justin Winslow, Quentin Cook, all very solid players, Quinn Cook, rather, and all very solid players. And the key will be to match up with those star players the best they can. I think the Badgers have a little deeper bench, so we'll give the starters a bit of a break, but they do have to have quite a challenge on their hands. But Wisconsin, we haven't said about. I've talked a lot about some of their stars besides Decker. Frank Kaminsky, of course, Player of the Year and a couple of major awards. Nigel Hayes, Bronson Koenig, Josh Gosser, all very seasoned players playing very well right now. And they've got Trayvon Jackson now off the bench, as well as a couple of other folks. All predictions are this will be a tight game.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of those players, we can't ignore the fact that they're students and, by association, temporary members of the team. Talk about what the team would look like next year. Who's sticking around and who's on their way out?
Well, for sure, on their way out, Frank Kaminsky, Josh Gosser, Duye Dukan, a reserve, and Trayvon Jackson, who was a starter for many years, but they got injured and now coming back. He's also a senior. So for their eight, if you will. Then Sam Decker, the star forward, is a junior, finishing up as a junior. There are strong rumors that he might leave. If he wins tonight, the Badgers win tonight, that might give him the boost to leave and say, what more can I accomplish? If they lose against Duke, perhaps he comes back and they try to saddle up one more time. So there's going to be some turnover. The Scots will get the remaining players who are younger, Bronson Koenig, Nigel Hayes. This certainly appears the Badgers will be a good team next year, but will they be Final Four material for 3 years in a row? That's uncertain. There's yet to be some freshmen, first-year students coming in who have helped other clubs. Sometimes they take a while to sort of, improve their skills at Wisconsin, because Wisconsin doesn't tend to recruit these McDonald's All-Americans, if you will, and recruit lesser-in-demand players, but grow them into better players. So Wisconsin could add some first-year players next year, whether they'll be as dazzling as some of the players for other teams like Okafor for Duke is a question.
And finally, apart from the title itself, what's at stake for Wisconsin tonight? Would a win make a difference in UW athletics in years to come?
Well, I think that there is still, as we talked about a moment ago, this basketball royalty. Wisconsin not quite there yet because they haven't won in 74 years. This would help. This would presumably help recruiting. This would presumably help marketing, merchandising, the sales of clothing, et cetera, that goes along with national champions. But they are on this stage as at least the number two team in the country, so that helps right there. But to get to number one, that would mean a lot. It would mean a lot to alumni who perhaps remember 30 years or 60 years of sort of indifferent play, mediocre play. In the last few years, they've been very good again, and a lot of alumni of a certain age are, shaking hands and talking about that. They haven't discussed Badger basketball much in the last 30 years otherwise.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the game tonight.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Chuck Quirenbach joining us from Indianapolis, where he's covering the NCAA championship match between Duke and Wisconsin. 57 school districts have referendums up for consideration in tomorrow's election. Coming up, we'll talk to an education reporter about what these referendums are and why there are so many of them. First, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, informally known as Obamacare, just celebrated its fifth anniversary a few weeks ago. But some experts say provisions included in the law have added to the list of disadvantages that rural hospitals face. For a look at how rural hospitals are doing, we turn to a couple of guests. First, Maggie Elawani is with us. She's the Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Rural Health Association. Maggie, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
And we also have Tim Size with us. He's the Executive Director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Maggie, let's start with you. On a national level, how are rural hospitals doing?
On a national level, rural hospitals are receiving probably the greatest challenges they've had since their existence. We went through a very tough time in the 80s and early 90s when Congress changed the payment system for rural hospitals to something called the prospective payment system, kind of a volume-based system. It didn't work for small rural hospitals. We saw 400 rural hospitals close across the country. That was a tremendous crisis. We're at the beginning of a crisis that is just as significant, if not more significant now. We've seen 48 rural hospitals closed since 2010, but really what we have is another 283 that are on the verge of closing because of provisions in the ACA, but because of a whole host of other provisions, largely enforced by Congress and also the administration. So it's an incredibly challenging time for rural hospitals.
Give us some background there. You'd think that after, if there were some significant crises in the 80s and 90s, we might have learned to do something differently. But what might be at play today that might be contributing to these more significant challenges that you talk about?
Well, Congress, I think, does like to do the right thing, but they're so slow in doing the right thing. So Congress slowly reacted to those 400 rural hospitals that closed, forcing many rural patients, obviously, to be without their local access to care in a local emergency room. And they created kind of these unique payments for small rural hospitals to keep their doors open. The most significant of those payments was in 1997 Balanced Budget Act, and that was the creation of the Critical Access Hospital. Very small hospitals, 25 beds or fewer, and it gave them slightly enhanced payments to make sure they were able to keep their doors open. Well, because of so many different types of cuts and, again, challenges to that Critical Access Hospitals, a lot of folks, members of Congress and other bodies that advise Congress calling for cuts to those hospitals, we think it's because they really don't understand the importance of the payment structure of those hospitals. But nevertheless, those cuts are being called for, challenging those hospitals. Really think that that's going to cause many, many more closures. Congress, again, slowly reacts to this and slowly reacts to really changes in health care. That was based on kind of the inpatient days that a patient has. We know that medicine has really evolved in the last couple of decades for certain, and really what is needed, maybe not be that many inpatient bed days, but just some good quality primary care. Wisconsin is a great example of where they're figuring out ways to do great quality primary care in rural communities. Other parts of the country are really struggling. Some of the poorest areas of the country, populations in the Deep South and in Appalachia, certain parts of the West, that's where we're seeing a lot of these hospital closures.
And Tim, let's bring the focus closer to Wisconsin for just a moment. How are rural hospitals doing in the state?
Well, first I want to say at a national level, I totally agree with Maggie. The Medicare program has become, for too many rural hospitals, death by a thousand cuts. And part of it's the Accountable Care Act, Obamacare, but it's also other laws that have been in place. There's, in Wisconsin, we're a little bit different story. We have hospitals that are challenged. I don't think to the same proportion as the country as a whole. In fact, I'd go even further to say we have a lot to celebrate in Wisconsin. And let me just share a few facts. 15 of the top performing 100 rural hospitals in the country are in Wisconsin. So that's four times that found in the average state, four times greater. Wisconsin is one of three states with large rural populations that stands head and shoulders above other states when you look at Medicare's rating for patient outcomes and experience. And when you look at our own University of Wisconsin County Health Rankings, just came out a couple weeks ago, we have a lot of work still to do, but rural counties are actually doing better than predicted. So we are facing many of the same challenges that Maggie mentioned, and in a minute I can add to that list of challenges. But in fact, rural hospitals are, as a group are strong in Wisconsin.
Why is Wisconsin standing out above some of these other states in terms of success?
I think there's a lot of reasons. I think there's a tradition of collaboration in the upper Midwest. So you look at Minnesota, northern Iowa, Wisconsin, we tend to look good. There is a tradition of multi-specialty clinic systems, both within rural communities and amongst rural communities. We have a strong hospital association. We have a strong cooperative who I work for of 39 rural hospitals. We were early into asking the questions about how we can get more team-related care, how we can focus more on value, how we can focus more on the health of the community. And frankly, some other variables that we can't claim credit for, but just simply rural communities in Wisconsin in general are economically stronger than communities in parts of the South and the West. And since healthcare is very much not only what healthcare providers do, but it's a function of the level of education, the level of jobs. We start a little bit ahead of the game.
I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking with two experts on the state of rural hospitals as the Affordable Care Act celebrates its fifth anniversary. That's Tim Size. He's executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. And we're also talking with Maggie Elawani. She is the vice president of government affairs for the National Rural Health Association. And Maggie, looking specifically at the Affordable Care Act, how have those changes specifically impacted rural hospitals and the way that they operate?
Sure. There was a lot of positives for rural health care, for rural patients that were included when the Affordable Care Act was drafted. Unfortunately, many of those provisions were never fully funded or funded at all by Congress. So it's important to look back at the two big issues we're talking here. What we're talking about are the disparities among rural populations. They are generally older, poorer, and sicker per capita. It's also incredibly important to remember what that rural hospital, the impact that that rural hospital has, not only for the patients in that community, but for the whole rural economy. The hospital is usually the largest or second largest employer, provides a tremendous revenue, and generates much of the economic engine of a rural community, let alone attracts businesses to the community or helps families and retirees stay there. So when you look at that importance and you look at what happens when one of those facilities closes, what we're seeing by these hospital closings and the potential of nearly 300 closing are creating these medical deserts across the country. So what happened in the Affordable Care Act was there were provisions to help some of these challenges in rural areas, to help improve workforce issues, to help enhance certain payments. Again, a lot of those weren't funded, but some of the negatives for healthcare providers, some cuts in Medicare reimbursement rates were absolutely included in the Affordable Care Act as a way to pay for the overall price tag of the bill. So what happens is these dish cuts affect a lot of the rural prospective payment hospitals, these small rural, a little bit better than bigger than the 25-bed hospitals. It hits them and says that because we expect you folks to have a lot more of your paying customers because people have insurance now, we're going to assume that you don't have as much of uncompensated care and you're not providing as much. And so it's really hitting a lot of these small rural hospitals that have the narrowest, operate on the narrowest of financial margins. What we're seeing in a lot of the states, especially those states that haven't expanded Medicaid, they took the Supreme Court up on their offer to choose not to expand Medicaid. We're seeing a lot of these large uninsured areas where these people get sick, have to show up in an emergency room. Maybe they could have had health care under the ACA, but they don't. they still show up in the emergency room where they're, you know, their most expensive way to provide primary care in many cases.
Right.
And
Tim,
that's really detrimental on these hospitals.
Tim, in our final minute here, how important are rural hospitals, or what are you doing specifically with Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative to help these hospitals manage the challenges ahead of them?
Well, the co-op is a cooperative, just like in Wisconsin, so familiar with. So we actually work for them and with them. And the cooperative is the rural hospitals supporting each other. We're working across the board. We talked a lot about Medicare. There's a whole host of issues around Medicaid that affect their financial health, and we're grateful for the legislature for the dollars they're putting in this session. We're working with the insurance commissioner in terms of issues around network adequacy, and that basically is fancy language for who health insurers will contract or non-contract with. And there are more and more cases where insurers are not contracting because they're trying to create a very narrow network. We're working in workforce. Baby boomers are retiring out of being caregivers into being patients, and that creates a particular challenge in rural Wisconsin because it's an older population. I can go down a longer list, but well, you've only got so much time.
It's true. Thank you so much for being with us, Maggie and Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
That was Tim. Maggie Alwani, she's Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Rural Health Association, and Tim Size, he's Executive Director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. They were talking to us about the state of rural hospitals following the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster. Tomorrow is Election Day in Wisconsin, and 57 school districts around the state have referendum questions on their ballot. The Wisconsin State Journal reports many school districts are looking for extra funds for construction projects or to maintain educational programming. Molly Beck is with us to talk about what's on some of these ballots tomorrow and about the high number of school district referendums in Wisconsin. She's an education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So 57 school referendums are under consideration tomorrow. That seems like quite a lot. Mm-hmm. How does the number of referendums compare to the last handful of elections?
Actually, there's 74 in 56 school districts, so some school districts have more than one going on. And that compares, that's on the high side in the last few elections. There were, let's see here, 53, 43, and 51 in the last three elections. So it is on the high side compared to the past three.
And it's hard to talk about that without also calling to mind the state budget and the revenue caps that are proposed, at least. So is that the correlation, or is it for now a coincidence?
That's the only way that school districts can exceed their revenue caps. So there's obviously a correlation there. When you look at the kind of referendums that the school districts are asking voters to approve, about half are for construction and building new schools or upgrading them, things like that. And about half are for operating expenses. So when you look at history, I would say that there's probably a little bit more referendums asking for operating expenses than there have been in maybe the last 10 years. But right now it's about half and half. So,
and does the nature of the referendum, whether it is operating expenses or it's the construction of a new building or a new wing, does that influence whether or not these referendums are liable to pass?
I think it does. When I was looking at the past few years, there seems to be more support for building new schools than operating expenses, or for, especially for referendums that are for recurring expenses, where, you know, non-recurring referendums are just for, you know, one-time costs. And of course, school districts can come back to voters every year if they wanted to. I think there's a school district in Benton that has done that. But the type of referendums where it's ongoing, those are much, much less successful.
And obviously, there are a lot of referendums. So are there any that are overarching in terms of the trends or themes among the ballot questions that we're going to see tomorrow?
I've seen a lot of construction, especially among the higher dollar referendums. The, you know, Madison and DeForest are both in Dane County school districts. They're both asking for $41 million, and that's to address facilities. And the largest in the state is Port Washington, Saukville, and they're asking for $49 million, and that would be for upgrading security and relieving crowded classrooms and also upgrading the high school there. So,
school districts say that they need them, you know, to change to keep up with the evolving structure in terms of the funding. What's the argument against all these referendums, though?
It's property taxes. You know, I think when I hear from readers, whenever I write about a referendum, it's always about why can't school districts, you know, make do? But there are some high dollar projects that school districts want to do that probably couldn't be absorbed in a single year budget.
What is the breaking point then for taxpayers, especially if we'll see more referendums in the future in the in light of some tighter public school funding? Is it a dollar figure? Is it the nature of the referendums? What is it for the taxpayer to say, nope, I can't keep doing this anymore?
I mean, that's a great question, and I think it really depends on the community. I know in Madison there's a strong support for the public school district here, and especially after Act 10, you know, I could see the public being supportive here. But in other communities, you know, it just depends on the political climate and how much trust that community has in the school board to, you know, use the money wisely and things like that. So it's hard to say, you know, if there's a uniform breaking point for voters, you know, but I really think it depends on the community and what's going on.
And not just the political leanings, perhaps, of that community, but I wonder how much the size of the community also plays into it. Do you find that smaller districts are at a disadvantage financially, or are the costs to taxpayers proportional to the size of the community or the school district?
Yeah, I mean, that depends also where these communities are. Like the smaller rural districts, you know, that everyone says they've been hurt especially hard with, you know, the last couple budgets where, you know, school funding hasn't increased a whole lot from the state. And they're trying to keep up with other school districts, you know, competing for students, especially with open enrollment and you know, school choice and things like that. So, you know, trying to keep up with what's going on, and especially with the new, you know, Common Core state standards and trying to upgrade the curriculum and things like that. It's, you know, it all costs money. So,
It's a lot to keep track of. And so meanwhile, parents and other district residents have to consider all those factors. I was looking at some of the, referendums around the state, and among them was an Adams Friendship. The school district wants $2.5 million to build a fine arts center. I look at that as opposed to some of the things you talked about, and I wonder to what extent voters say, do we really need a fine arts center? But then you also mentioned that construction efforts tend to get passed or are more likely to get passed than ongoing costs. What's your sense in terms of something like a fine arts center versus a school, a new school?
Sure. I mean, debate actually, you know, has happened in Madison for many years. There's a auditorium at East High School that has, you know, voters have said that, or not voters, but residents have said that it really needs to be addressed. The facility isn't, you know, it's not a good facility, you know, according to them. And, but I think the argument against that has always been there's other pressing needs that maybe should be addressed before we talk about fine arts. It's not, you know, a core need of a school district, you know, but again, that goes back to the community and what, you know, what value they place on that.
We're talking with Molly Beck. She's an education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal on Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, and you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a referendum on your ballot? How do you intend to vote and why? You can let us know, 800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. You mentioned that DeForest is also asking for $41 million for a school building improvement plan and expansion of their technical education program. Where would this money come from? Primarily taxpayers, or is there another source of revenue?
It seems to be coming from the referendum issuing debt. And so that would come from taxpayers, and they want to build a brand new elementary school, put a major addition onto another elementary school, and an addition to the high school. And they also want to upgrade security, and all of that would be about $41 million, which, you know, compared to their operating budget, which is less than that. So it's a big project list.
And one of the themes from all of these referendums tends to be about lack of space. How bad is crowding in the schools, especially in southern Wisconsin?
Yeah. DeForest is a good example. They've said there's about 2,000 homes that are approved for development, so they're expecting their space needs to be something that they need to put a priority on. And Madison, too, they've said that, you know, they don't want to, you know, redraw boundaries if it's not going to alleviate crowding. And it looks like all of their elementary schools are near capacity, so that they need to do that too. When I looked, you know, down the list of what the needs were in the referendum list, it seems like crowding was a big, you know, reason that they were coming to voters.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with education reporter Molly Beck about the school referendums that you might see on your election ballot tomorrow. We're taking your calls. What do you think about the increasing number of school referendums in the state? Is there a referendum that will be on your ballot tomorrow, and how will you vote for it? How have schools in your district dealt with lower state funding? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now with education reporter Molly Beck about the school referendums that will be up for consideration in tomorrow's election. We're taking your calls on this. Will you have a school referendum on your ballot tomorrow? Maybe more than one. Does the nature of the referendum influence the way that you'll vote for it? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Picking up with some of these significant referendums around the state, Port Washington is asking for $49 million for construction money. Is your sense that that will get approved or not?
I think that there's probably some support for that. I didn't see any opposition, you know, pop up that would make me think otherwise. But yeah, and what they're asking to do is, you know, security and alleviating crowding. Those are things that parents can really identify with. Especially crowding, you know, that's a popular complaint among parents, you know, when that's going on.
And does that affect classroom size when it's not just, is it physical space or is it actual numbers of bodies in a classroom?
Yeah, I mean, it's both. And if you want to keep your class sizes down, you need to have more space for classes to go. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just put all of the kids in a small space. So it definitely has to do with class size, which is also important to parents, I've noticed in my reporting over the years. So
we have a call from Brock and Holman. Hi, Brock.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Well, I want to talk about the referendum. I heard, where I go to school, we're all going to get Chromebooks.
Phone books?
Chromebooks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes a lot more sense. Okay. And how do you feel about that?
Well, I feel instead of getting Chromebooks, since like you have to have internet to log in, so because you have to sign them with like Google, where if you took it home and you don't have internet at home, then you won't be able to get into it.
Yeah. So is this something that that you would like to see changed, or is it something that you look forward to using?
Well, it's kind of hard to say, because if they got MacBooks instead of Chromebooks, it would be easier to get in, and you wouldn't have to have internet to get into it.
Well, that's an interesting point, Brock. Is this something that's that is going to be taken up in your district, do you know?
Well, the referendum is actually going to be voted on tomorrow.
Okay. So. Well, thank you, Brock. If you could vote tomorrow, how would you vote?
I would probably vote no.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brock, for calling in. You can call in, too, at 800-642-1234. What about that? Not only do we have to consider whether to introduce technology into the classroom, but the type of technology and how accessible it is to everybody in the classroom.
Yeah, I cover the Madison School District, and that was a big question when they were proposing their district-wide technology plan. And actually, some of the technology costs are being rolled into their referendum question to relieve a little bit of pressure from the budget. But that his point that some kids may go home and not have internet access and some do, but mm-hmm. everybody's expected to have this device is an issue. And I know that the city of Madison has looked at putting in neighborhood Wi-Fi spots and things like that to help that. So that's a good point that he made.
It's nice to hear from our younger listeners. Bill in Orfordville is next. Hi, Bill.
Yes, a year ago here in Orfordville, we passed a $20 million bond issue for improvements to the high school, and it totally split the community, and it's still splitting the community now that everybody got their tax bills. I think there's a world of difference between Madison and rural Wisconsin as it relates to these referendums and things. Rural Wisconsin can't afford them. We can't afford $100,000 a year teachers and all the rest of that, and there's something to be said about the failure of public education in general. We still only vote 30% of the people in these off elections. I could go on and on and on, but there is not a pot of gold at the end of this rainbow out here. And what's going to happen in rural Wisconsin, referendums or not, is consolidation. You're not going to have the community schools anymore because there isn't any money. Population's in a great decline. Where there used to be five or six farm families, there's now one with the massive consolidation of farming, and there's no industry. So whether they want to spend money for this stuff, and like I call it Parkview folly down here, because they're going to graduate 10 kids, maybe they'll all go to Harvard, but you cannot keep spending money when there isn't a population, first of all, to support that, and a population to attend those schools.
Thank you for those comments, Bill. That's a lot to chew on there, and I guess if we can parse it out in a couple of different ways, starting with the lower population. Mm-hmm.
That's an issue. That's an issue for rural schools. They're seeing declining enrollment in some of those school districts, and that means less money from the state, but they still have a school district to run,
right.
You know, and so the idea of consolidation, I'm sure that's a fear among you know, residents there.
And one overarching theme of his comment, too, is sort of the short-term needs versus the long-term needs.
Yeah.
And so how do voters weigh that? How should they weigh that as they consider whether to cast a vote? He even mm-hmm. implied maybe some buyer's remorse in Orfordville following last year's referendum.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's how the school district spends the money, you know, ultimately. And there is some concern among some board members whenever this comes up that you know, you're especially when it comes to buildings, you're putting money in the short term, but maybe in the long term, you want to just replace the school. And is that, you know, fiscally smart to do, you know, to put money in when you're going to put money in again, maybe 5 years down the road? So it all depends on how pressing the needs are. If the facility is just it has to be addressed, then it has to be addressed, you know, to some of these communities.
He also talked about how these elections, these referendums, tend to take a back seat in terms of not just partly the timing. This is mm-hmm. a spring election. We know that the voter turnout is much lower in mm-hmm. spring elections. But also, how often are these things talked about prior to Election Day, as opposed to the actual candidates who might be on the ballot running for specific offices?
Sure, yeah. When I see school districts gear up for a referendum or even just you know, approaching the idea, it's months and months and months before they do it. And because it takes a lot of work. It takes a full-blown campaign to convince everybody, you know, and especially to explain what the needs are, because it can be very complicated, and just the nature of a referendum can be complicated. And also whether, you know, parents are going to see an immediate return on that, too. This could be, you know, something that is a more long term, and maybe it's harder to convince voters if they don't see an immediate effect with their property tax increases. So, you know, I think in DeForest they've been talking about this for 2 years, and in Madison they've been talking about it not quite that long, maybe about a year that they've been kind of looking at it. So it's not a quick thing, and I think most school boards know that.
We're talking with Molly Beck, education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Speaking of DeForest, John joins us from there. Hi, John.
Yes, you know, I used to live in Waupaca, and they had a referendum about 15, 20 years ago and built this really wonderful high school. And then 2 years later, the population fell back. And I'm concerned about that with the forest because, you know, we're projecting that there are 2,000 houses, there are 2,000 building permits in the forest, but that doesn't mean that there are going to be 2,000 houses. And I just am very fearful, like you were saying a little bit earlier, about the long-term impact, whether or not the schools will actually be able to be filled when they're built. I think that, you know, we could scale back a little bit on this referendum and it would be just fine.
Molly Beck?
Yeah, that's a good point. There are 2,000 homes approved for development, but there are not 2,000 new families in DeForest right now. So I'm sure that that's, you know, a top question of many voters, you know, whether or not that will actually come to be, and they'll need that extra space.
So going forward, is this the new norm in Wisconsin, more and more referendums as state funding gets harder to come by?
You know, I poked around and asked a few people that I talked to on my beat about what they think about that, and they didn't really have a definite, you know, idea that, yes, this is going to happen more and more, but certainly if, you know, they have a cut coming to school districts next year, if the budget is approved the way the governor has proposed it, if, you know, the funding stays flat like it has been, you could see that happening more and more.
And in terms of the state legislative makeup and how that impacts mm-hmm. things, do you see going forward that the trending structure will remain the same for a while, or might there be change on the horizon?
I've heard from some of the Republican leadership that they would like to put back some money for public school districts more than the governor's budget has proposed. So that could change.
Molly Beck, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Molly Beck, education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. She was with us to talk about some of the school referendums that you might see on your ballot when you vote tomorrow. The legendary vocalist Billie Holiday was born 100 years ago tomorrow. Though a household name today, she struggled to achieve the same notoriety as singers like Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald in her day. Like other black performers at the time, she faced racial discrimination, often at the hands of club managers and those who took issue with the black singer mingling with white musicians. Her band leaders and fellow artists like Artie Shaw and Tony Pastor were the first to stick up for her when it was necessary. Billie Holiday's calm, laid-back delivery masked a troubled story inside of her. Born to a 13-year-old mother and raised mostly by her grandmother, Holiday first sang simply to earn a living, not to pursue a passion. The hardships that underlined many aspects of her life were evident in some of the songs she recorded, if not cloaking her voice as she sang, then spelled out in the lyrics of songs like Strange Fruit and Gloomy Sunday. After a long struggle with narcotic drugs, Billie Holiday died on July 17, 1959.
They don't come no more. Rich relations give crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have.